Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 29th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. Let's take a moment to look at the weather for the next few days. Today and tomorrow, the weather is going to be generally seasonal, with a high today of 29 and a low of 15. Tomorrow, high of 24 and a low of 16. Both of those days are showing as partly cloudy, with winds around 10 to 20 miles an hour. Monday, it does get a little warmer with a high of 37 and a low of 24, but it is listed as mostly cloudy, and again, those winds around 10 to 20 miles an hour. If you're wondering how this fits with our normal, the normal high is 28 and the normal low is 11. But in 2013, there was a record high of 58, and in 1966, the low was minus 24, and that, of course, was a record. Meteorologist Corey Thompson has contributed this brief weather story called Taking a Break from Cold Air. January has been a cold one, which you likely don't need me to tell you, says Corey. Through late this week, our average temperature, a combination of all the temperatures in a day this January, has been almost 7 degrees below normal. Our warmest high has been 40 degrees, and if that holds, it would be the lowest maximum for the month since 2011. Fortunately, for those of us who aren't the biggest cold weather fans, the tail end of the month is likely to finish near or above normal. The big winner looks to be Monday, as I mentioned, when temperatures could climb into the upper 30s. This will chip away at our snow cover before a midweek system potentially brings some back. And he ends by saying, stay tuned. Moving to the Gazette's front page, there are two local stories. Both of them are court-related stories. The first from Trish Mahaffey, titled, Two Teens Responsible for Killing Sentenced. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A grieving grandmother said Friday she was at a loss for words because she never expected to lose her greatest precious gift, her grandson, Malik Sheets, who told her the day before he was fatally shot that he was going to graduate soon and she wouldn't want for anything. Havana Cooper, in her victim impact statement, read during sentencing hearings for two men convicted in her grandson's June 18, 2020 death at a Northeast Cedar Rapids party, Mashawn L. Jeffries, then 16, and Christian D. Emedi, 17 at the time, said instead of attending his graduation, she was attending a funeral. Cooper, at Emedi's hearing, raised her voice and scolded him for killing her grandson on her birthday and on Malik's mother's birthday, birthdays now ruined for the family. We don't need to lose any more children, Cooper said as she pounded her fist on the witness stand next to the judge's bench. The Sheets family and friends stood and clapped afterward. Carlos Sheets, Malik's father, also received applause when he said, he didn't forgive Jeffries and Emedi, now both 18, calling them cold-blooded killers. The father said he never had a chance to grieve for his firstborn son, because after the shooting, he was searching to find the killer. He was busy meeting with police and putting up flyers around town to stop and grieve. He still hasn't. Both sentencings were emotional, but after Emedi's hearing, a physical fight almost broke out. Emedi's friends exchanged words with the Sheets family and friends, and both were yelling at each other when Linn County Sheriff's deputies, who were in the courtroom, jumped in to separate the individuals and escorted them out. Sixth Judicial District Judge Ian Thornhill had already left the courtroom, but two prosecutors and two defense attorneys were still there. Deputies took out Emedi when it started. Nobody was arrested, according to the Linn County Attorney's Office. Emedi, originally charged with first-degree murder and obstruction of prosecution, previously pleaded to second-degree murder. During that plea hearing, Emedi admitted to firing all five shots that killed Sheets, who died from injuries to his neck and chest. He admitted to all elements of the charge, but entered an Alford plea to one of the elements, malice aforethought, or intentionally doing an unlawful act with an intent to cause injury. In an Alford plea, a defendant does not admit guilt, but admits the prosecution has enough evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Emedi declined to make a statement Friday at sentencing. Thornhill sentenced him to 50 years in prison, but suspended all but 15 years to serve, which was part of the plea agreement. There is no mandatory minimum sentence for juveniles, so Ametti could be paroled before the 15 years is served. Ametti also was sentenced to 5 years in prison, which Thornhill ran concurrently with the 15 years in a separate case. He was convicted of willful injury causing bodily injury when he and Cordall R. Lewis assaulted Kevon Johnson in 2020, punching and stomping him. Lewis and Johnson were discovered dead this week in two separate homicides in southeast Cedar Rapids. Police would not say if the homicides were related, and no arrests had been made. Jeffries, also originally charged with first-degree murder and obstruction of prosecution, previously pleaded to a new charge of intimidation with a dangerous weapon, a felony, and to obstruction, a misdemeanor. Jeffries, in the written plea for the gun charge, admitted he threatened to shoot a firearm into a group of people during the party when Sheets was fatally shot. In the obstruction plea, Jeffries admitted to destroying, altering, concealing, or disguising physical evidence with the intent to prevent an arrest or to obstruct the prosecution of another person, Ametti, in the fatal shooting. Jeffries also declined to make a statement during sentencing. Thornhill sentenced Jeffries to 5 years on the gun charge. He said Jeffries would receive the 2 years on the obstruction conviction as time served. He has been in jail since June 2020. Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks, during the sentencing, said people involved in this tragic incident were not being truthful to police during this investigation, and it took some time to find out who actually shot Sheets. Maybanks, during Jeffrey's sentencing, said Jeffries didn't shoot Sheets, but he bears responsibility for his part in this escalating argument that turned deadly. Jeffries pulled out a gun and pointed it at one person and was in a fight with another when Sheets was shot. Jeffries then concealed the identity of the shooter, Ametti. In other hearings Friday, Aaliyah Anderman, 19, and Miguel Ruiz, age 26, were sentenced for their part in Sheets' death. They weren't involved in the killing, but helped cover up the crime after it happened. Anderman, Ametti's girlfriend at the time, pleaded to accessory after the fact and received a deferred judgment and 2 years probation. Ruiz, Jeffrey's brother, pleaded to accessory after the fact and obstruction of prosecution. Both 2-year sentences ran concurrently, and Ruiz was sentenced to 2 years in prison. The story is accompanied by a picture of Havana Cooper, the grandmother of the murder victim, Malik Sheets, a very animated picture as she is giving her victim impact statement on the stand. She is in a position where she looks as if she is speaking in a very loud voice into the microphone as she sits at that witness stand. The other crime-related story on the front page of the Gazette is by Clark Kaufman. It is reprinted from the Iowa Capital Dispatch, and it is titled Lottery Scammer Eddie Tipton Out on Parole. It is a lengthy story, so I am going to read excerpts to give you the idea of the story, but perhaps will not read the entire story. An Iowa man convicted of rigging the lottery to fraudulently claim millions in jackpots has been paroled after 4.5 years behind bars. The Iowa Board of Parole has approved the release of Eddie Tipton, the former Information Security Director of the Multi-State Lottery Association based in Urbandale. Tipton was arrested in 2015 and accused of installing computer code on lottery computers that allowed him to predict the winning numbers. His efforts to rig the drawings were uncovered after Iowa lottery officials grew suspicious over an anonymous attempt to claim a $16.5 million hot lotto jackpot. They eventually linked Tipton, his brother Tommy, and a longtime friend Robert Rhodes to suspicious winnings claimed in 5 states. Tipton was convicted on 2 counts of fraud stemming from the scheme to claim the hot lotto jackpot, with a ticket purchased at a Des Moines convenience store. The Iowa Supreme Court later overturned that conviction, stating that investigators had taken too long to charge and prosecute Tipton. By then, Tipton was already scheduled to plead guilty to separate but related charges of ongoing criminal conduct. Those grew out of an investigation into other rigged lottery drawings. Tipton was ordered to serve a prison sentence of no more than 25 years and had to pay about $2.2 million in restitution. The amount was later reduced to about $1.6 million. His sentence was ordered to be served concurrently with a sentence imposed in Wisconsin, where he pleaded guilty to felony charges of fraud and computer crime that were tied to a 2007 lottery game. Tipton later filed court papers seeking post-conviction relief and claimed he was innocent of the crimes he'd pleaded guilty to in Iowa, arguing that his sentence amounted to cruel and unusual because it applied to an actually innocent person. He attempted to have the sentence set aside, claimed he was under duress when he pleaded guilty, and said Iowa officials charged him for restitution for winnings claimed in other states where Iowa has no jurisdiction. A trial on that issue is scheduled for August 17th. In this parole agreement, he is being released to the state of Texas, where he will be subject to parole supervision in that state. As with any parole, failure to comply with state, local, or federal laws could result in revocation of that parole. Moving to the Iowa Today section, there is a brief story from Grace King that sort of relates to the first story that we read together, and this is titled, Two Fatal Shootings in 2 Days. Police are investigating a second fatal shooting in less than 24 hours in southeast Cedar Rapids, and court records show the two men who died had been involved in a fight in 2020. The body of Kayvon Ibrahim Johnson, age 22, was found at 7:25 a.m. Friday in a parking lot at Cedar Valley Park, and then Johnson appeared to have died from one or more gunshot wounds, according to a city news release. Officials did not say if the shooting happened at the park. Police also identified Cordall R. Lewis, age 19, as the man found fatally shot Thursday afternoon in the 300 block of 31st Street Drive Southeast. Police found his body in the street at 2:39 p.m. with one or more gunshot wounds, according to a news release. Both shootings appear to be targeted incidents. They did not say if the incidents were related, and no suspects have been arrested. Lewis and two other men were charged with assaulting Johnson on June 17, 2020. Lewis pleaded guilty to assault, causing bodily injury, a serious misdemeanor, and served time in the Linn County Jail. Christian Emedi and Marshawn Jeffries also were charged in the assault of Johnson, and as we read earlier, they were sentenced Friday in the June 18, 2020 murder of Malik Sheets. Moving to some other topics, we're moving to the Iowa Today section, and this is from Aaron Murphy. Jailing teachers over books is not a good idea, says Iowa Senate leader. The dateline here is Des Moines. Teachers should not have to worry about jail time for distributing books that some people might consider vulgar, said Republican Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker on Friday while appearing on this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Whitaker was asked about comments he made before the legislative session by two Senate Republicans, Senators Jake Chapman of Adel and Brad Zahn of Urbandale, who said they felt educators should face jail time for distributing literature they deemed vulgar or obscene. When asked about the possibility of criminal penalties for teachers, Whitaker on Friday appeared to dismiss the idea, saying, "I think charging anyone with felonies for these types of things, I don't think, is a good idea." Whitaker said no legislation has been proposed in the Senate that would criminalize the distribution of certain literature in schools. Republican lawmakers are hearing concerns from parents about some books in schools and their libraries. When books have been singled out by legislators or at school board meetings, they typically have been about LGBTQ characters or written by LGBTQ authors and include brief passages that describe sexual acts or feelings. Whitaker said he thinks the topic should be addressed through transparency. That aligns with Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, who proposed legislation that would require schools to post a catalog of all their library books and curriculum materials online. Schools are already required to have that information available. Whitaker said, "We're hearing concerns from parents, and our job is to listen to those concerns and try to address them. I think adding transparency is a really good way to do that. Make sure our parents have a seat at the table in their kids' education. Give them a process to address any concerns they have," end quote. Many school districts already have a process for considering books and other materials that some people may deem inappropriate. The phenomenon is not unique to Iowa, and other states' elected officials have taken action. Florida's Republican lawmakers are considering legislation that would ban schools from, in their instruction, making people feel discomfort over historic actions by their race, nationality, or gender. And a Tennessee school board banned a book about the Holocaust over concerns of graphic drawings. Also from the Iowa Today page, Marion looking at $113 million in expenditures for 2023 budget. And this is by Gage Miskimen. The Marion City budget for the new fiscal year will reflect the opening of two new facilities, the Marion Public Library and the Marion Fire Department headquarters. New city manager Ryan Waller, who's been on the job for a month, said, "We have these great new assets to our community that are needed for a community that is growing like ours. This is great for us." The proposed fiscal 2023 budget presented to the Marion City Council on Friday morning is basically a status quo budget, he said. A $113 million expenditure budget is proposed for fiscal 2023, which begins July 1st and ends June 30th of 2023. The proposed general fund budget, which covers public safety, parks and rec, and other city operational costs, is $28 million, about the same as this fiscal year. No new hires are recommended. The capital expenditure proposal totals around $37 million. Included is money for 7th Avenue improvements, Uptown Plaza and Depot development, trail improvements, and the next phases of Tower Terrace roadwork. The council is to conduct a public hearing on the budget March 17th before approving the spending plan for the new budget year. The proposed property tax rate to support the new budget is $14.34 per $1,000 of taxable valuation, up this year from this year's $14.20 rate. Though the rate is higher, the owner of a $200,000 house will pay $1,553 in city property taxes, a decrease of $49 from this fiscal year. The budget memo reads, "Even though the rate is up from last year, the impact to residents will be negligible due to the growth of our community and the state rollback." Waller said the city is losing $1.1 million in revenue because of changes in the state rollback percentage and the Iowa legislature phasing out the backfill that the state has provided local governments since it cut the commercial property tax rate in 2013. Waller said, "When they're doing that, we're losing money. It's challenging when communities are told one thing and something else happens later. We have to deal with that reality," end quote. The new Marion Public Library, being built between the old library and Marion City Hall, is to open within the next few months, with construction set to finish in mid-February. The library's proposed budget for fiscal year 23 is $2.58 million, an increase of 12.8% from this fiscal year, when it operated in a storefront location after derecho damage to the old library at 1095 6th Avenue. The proposed budget calls for raising the wages for part-time shelvers from $8 to $11 an hour. If approved, Marion will move from having the second lowest pay for shelvers among peer libraries to the second highest, Library Director Bill Carroll said. The Marion Fire Department is proposing a $5.9 million budget, an increase of 6.6%, to reflect costs of the new headquarters at 100 Irish Drive, overtime, and on-call expenses. A budget of $7.92 million is proposed for the Marion Police Department, an increase of just over 1%. The department responded to 29,692 calls for service in 2021. The city also is increasing sanitary sewer fees from 4.39 to 4.60 per flow unit due to increasing costs for wastewater treatment. That means an increase of about $1.26 per month for a single-family home that uses around 600 cubic feet of water per month. There is a story reprinted here from the Associated Press titled "Omicron Drives U.S. Deaths Higher Than Delta." Omicron, the highly contagious coronavirus variant sweeping the country, is driving the daily U.S. death toll higher than during last fall's Delta wave, with deaths likely to keep rising for days or even weeks. The 7-day rolling average for daily new COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. has been climbing since mid-November, reaching 2,267 on Thursday and surpassing a September peak of 2,100 when Delta was the dominant variant. Now, Omicron is estimated to account for nearly all the virus circulating in the nation, and even though it causes less severe disease for most people, the fact that it is more transmissible means more people are falling ill and dying. Andrew Neumer, a public health professor at the University of California at Irvine, said, "Omicron will push us over 1 million deaths. That will cause a lot of soul searching. There will be a lot of discussion about what we could have done differently, how many of the deaths were preventable." The average daily death toll now is at the same level as last February, when the country was coming off its all-time high of 3,300 a day. More Americans are taking precautionary measures against the virus than before the Omicron surge, according to an AP NORC poll this week. But many people, fatigued by crisis, are returning to some level of normality with hopes that vaccinations or prior infections will protect them. Omicron symptoms are often milder, and some infected people show none, researchers agree, but, like the flu, it can be deadly, especially for people who are older, have health problems, or are unvaccinated. Center for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said this week at a briefing, "Milder does not mean mild." At one urban hospital in Kansas, 50 COVID-19 patients have died this month, and over 200 are being treated. University of Kansas Hospital in Kansas City, Kansas, posted a video from its morgue showing bagged bodies in a refrigeration unit and a worker marking one white body bag with the word COVID. Dr. Katie Dennis, who does autopsies for the health system, said the morgue has been at or above capacity almost every day in January, which is definitely unusual. Also unusual is that on the Insight page, all four of the pieces of it are local. So we're going to cover as many as we can. We want to make sure we leave room for sports and the other options, including obituaries. So let's start with the Gazette's editorial. And it is an editorial written by the Gazette staff, and it is titled, "Scrap the Asset Test Bill." Republicans who control the Iowa legislature are considering a bill that would require Iowans receiving benefits through the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also called SNAP, more commonly known as food assistance, to pass an asset test to remain eligible. Iowa currently requires recipients to meet an income threshold but does not restrict assets. Under the bill, HSB 508, a household with more than $2,000 in the bank could lose benefits. A family with a second vehicle worth more than $4,650 could be denied food assistance, among other personal property and assets that could be counted against recipients. Forget saving money for emergencies. Forget having dependable vehicles if more than one adult in a household is working or needs transportation. Forget the fact that many SNAP recipients are children or elderly people. More than half of recipients are younger than 18 and older than 59. In short, lawmakers should forget about this bill. The bill is among several similar measures putting new limits, restrictions, and hurdles in front of struggling Iowans trying to keep food on the table. And like so many bad ideas at the Statehouse, they're being pushed by an outside conservative group. At a subcommittee meeting on the bill this week, the Florida-based Opportunity Solutions Project argued adopting an asset test would kick 60,000 Iowans off food assistance. In the group's book, that's a victory. It's been pushing for similar bills across the country, while seeking to cut other holes in the social safety net by fighting Medicaid expansion and other measures. A representative of Opportunity Solutions Project told lawmakers of a retired Minnesota millionaire who passed the income test in that state and was declared eligible for SNAP. Cheap gimmicks aside, the group argues changes would save money and push people back to work. Although it would save federal dollars, the state likely would end up spending more to administer new restrictions and monitoring. And taking food away from families as an incentive to work does not sound like an Iowa idea. At the meeting, a representative of the American Heart Association worried how asset hurdles would hurt recipients with health problems and children who need nutritious food. The AARP opposes the bill due to its potential impact on low-income seniors who might lose assistance due to, quote, a bingo win. Others expressed concerns about how limits would harm already economically stressed households, many with adults working for low wages, and return them to poverty. Iowa's SNAP numbers already are shrinking. In Iowa, 284,000 Iowans were receiving help, down from 308,000 in June 2020. And no millionaires that we know of. These bills are misguided, cruel, and unneeded, and the editorial ends, and hunger is not a workforce development strategy. Also on the Gazette's Insight page, which as you recall is an opinion page, we have a contribution and a guest column from Chris McCarville, who is president from Xavier High School. It is a fairly lengthy guest column, so again, I'm going to choose relevant excerpts so that we can get to all the other material. And it is titled, A Surprising Year for Catholic Schools. When this school year began at Xavier High School, we were greeted with a pleasant surprise. That pleasant surprise, increasingly, families are looking at Xavier as an option for their son or daughter's educational experience. Xavier began 10 students above projected enrollment. Additionally, when we returned from Christmas break, we had 4 new students transfer in. Perhaps those numbers do not seem like a lot, but history at Xavier tells us otherwise. These trends are not typical. This year's trend within the school runs contrary to statistics nationwide for Catholic schools in regard to enrollment, which has been trending downward. Mr. McCarville asks why the recent jump in enrollment here? To me, 3 reasons stand out. First, during the 2021 school, where educating students was especially difficult due to COVID-19, our school shined. We place a high value on something we believe has always been a strength of ours, community. We offered in-person learning the entire school year. We continually believed we needed to be together, not apart, as much as possible. Our faculty and staff worked hard to achieve that, and our community owes them a debt of gratitude we likely will never be able to repay. Second, our size and organizational structure allows us the ability and flexibility to adjust as necessary when unforeseen situations arise. We can pivot and attend as needed to each individual's and unique needs. Additionally, we can do the same when making difficult decisions that affect the larger school community. And third, most importantly, he says, Xavier High School is rooted in Jesus Christ. It seems society is doing everything it can today to take Jesus out of our lives. At Xavier, we believe now more than ever, an atmosphere, environment, and expectation centered on Christ is needed, especially for teenagers. He also touts that their tuition assistance program and says this school year alone, over $500,000 has been awarded in tuition assistance to our families at Xavier High School. From January 30th to February 5th, Xavier will join thousands of Catholic schools across the country celebrating National Catholic Schools Week. We celebrate because of our incredible students and teachers, because of our unique community and structure, and most of all, the fact that we are rooted in Christ. And that, as they say, makes all the difference. And again, this is a guest column contributed by Chris McCarville, who is president of Xavier High School. And last on the Insight page for today is community letters, and we have one today contributed from Thomas Rendon of Des Moines, and it's titled, Iowa Lawmakers Should Keep Child Care Safe. COVID-19 has hit Iowa's child care industry very hard. Centers have closed, infected providers stopped working. Workforce shortages and increased safety precautions have made child care a difficult, sometimes impossible, job. That leaves working parents stranded without the essential support childcare provides. How is the 2022 Iowa legislature addressing the problem? House Study Bill 511 calls for making childcare less safe by increasing the child-to-adult ratio far higher than national experts recommend. This reckless approach won't fix the problem. Instead, it will increase group size and the spread of infection, not a good idea during a pandemic, increase the chance a child could be in danger, and provide less than one-on-one time for nurturing and stimulation at a time when a child's brain is at peak development. Last week, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine published an exhaustive set of recommendations to address center closing, assist the workforce, modify subsidy and reimbursement, and improve system coordination. Iowa DHS is even doing some of these things, but nowhere do they recommend changing health and safety standards. Please urge your state representative to oppose this ill-advised legislation. Instead, encourage increased financial and technical support for child care, says Thomas Rendon of Des Moines. And we want to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, January 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. We will start with the short notices from Maquoketa. John Orville Edwards, age 71, died this past Wednesday. Arrangements will be made through Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. From Toledo, Dennis Ralph Wilkerson, age 60, died Thursday, January 27th. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama and Toledo, is assisting that family. In Victor, Avis Jean Fraker, age 87, died yesterday, and the arrangements are being made through Van Steenhuis Funeral, Tien Funeral Home in Vinton. And from Waukon, Linda M. Lee, L-E-A, age 69, of Mendota Heights, Minnesota, but formerly of Waukon, died Wednesday, January 25th, and those arrangements are being made through Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon. Moving to the longer obituaries, Judith Kahn, age 79, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, January 26th, at the Paula Faber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge, following a lengthy illness. Her funeral will be held this Tuesday, February 1st at 11 a.m. at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service, also at the funeral home. Next, Helen Louise Carol Cotman, age 96, passed away at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids on January 24th. Visitation will be held this coming Friday, February 4th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Lensing Funeral Service in Iowa City, with the funeral Saturday, February 5th, at 11 a.m. at Zion Lutheran Church in Iowa City. A private family burial will take place at Memory Gardens Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family offers that you make donations or memorial donations to the family to be donated to the Iowa City Hospice. Next, from Marion, Ryan J. Lonizak. I'm going to spell this because I don't know if I pronounced it properly. L-A-W-N-I-C-Z-A-K. He's age 44. He died January 5th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics following a brief illness. Services will be held at a later date that will be announced. For a complete obituary, future information, and to share a condolence, memory, or thought, you are invited to visit the Gay and Sheena Funeral and Cremation Service website, and it's just www.gayandchia.com. Next, Barbara Ann Rosate, it might be Rosate, R-O-S-S-A-T-E, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, died at home on Tuesday, January 25th. Visitation will be at 10 a.m., on Monday, this coming Monday, January 31st, followed by a funeral service at 11 a.m. Both will occur at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Marion. Burial will be at 2 p.m. Monday afternoon at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. The arrangements are being held through Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. And those who would like to attend via live stream are invited to find that live stream link by going to the stuartbaxter.com website and following through to Barbara's obituary, where you will find that link. The family does invite people who wish to do so to make donations in her memory to the Organ and Piano Fund of the St. Mark's Lutheran Church Foundation. Next, from Riverside, Dennis Jennings, also known as DJ, age 77, passed away January 25th at his residence. An informal gathering open house will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Monday, January 31st, at Lensing's Oak Hill location in Coralville. And in lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Open Heartland in Iowa City. From Bennett, Iowa, Shirley Ann Richards, Von Munster Wilkins, entered eternity, it says, on Wednesday, January 26th, while at Cedar Manor Nursing Home. On Saturday, January 29th, today, Peace Church of Christ United in Bennett will host a visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. and funeral service at 11 a.m. So I'm not sure whether this will be broadcast in time for folks to make those arrangements, but immediately following the funeral, she will be laid to rest at the Inland Cemetery in Bennett. A luncheon will be held at the Bennett Legion Hall around 12:30, and folks are invited to share online condolences and view her full obituary at the funeral home website, fryfuneralhome.com. From Cedar Rapids, Joyce L. Wibe, W-I-B-E, age 72, passed away at home on January 22nd after a fall and then various hospital stays. As for a funeral service, the obituary notice says Joyce did not want a funeral service, but instead a party, so that friends and family may gather to remember her. The family will plan such a party for later this year when the weather is better, and she asked that in lieu of flowers, people make donations in her name to Hospice Care at St. Luke's or the Edmund J. Safra, S-A-F-R-A, Family Lodge, at NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. From Marion, Gloria Jean Wybold Stenzel, age 86, died Wednesday, January 26th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. The funeral will be held at 11 a.m. this coming Monday, January 31st, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Marion, with a visitation 1 hour prior. The live stream of the service can be accessed through the church's Facebook page. Burial will take place Tuesday, February 1st at 1 p.m. at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Blairstown. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. The family expresses particular appreciation for all the love and compassionate care Gloria received from doctors and nurses, including the entire staff at Hall Perron Cancer Center and her caregivers at Hospice House of Mercy. And in lieu of flowers, they invite those who wish to do so to make donations in her memory to St. Paul's Lutheran Church or the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. And now, Grayson Hunt Schmenke, age 5, passed away Thursday, January 27th, at his home. Celebration of Life service will be held Tuesday, February 1st at 10:30 a.m. at Emmanuel Lutheran Cemetery near Williamsburg. Visitation will be this Monday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. And our final obituary today is from Coralville. Donald Norman Baird, age 91, died at home Thursday, January 27th. graveside services with military honors will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, February 1st at Oak Hill Cemetery. The family asks that in lieu of flowers, memorials be directed to Grace United Methodist Church, and that is in Tiffin. And now we're going to move to sports. We're going to try and do equal justice to both girls and boys basketball, depending on what our time allows here. In girls basketball, Jeff Linder has provided a story titled Boards Trump Turnovers in West's Victory. Dateline Cedar Rapids, rebounding is a little bit talent, a little bit technique, and, as Anna Prouty said, it's effort. It's what you have to do. Prouty led Iowa City West's effort on the boards, and the Class 5A fifth-ranked Trojans overcame 25 turnovers to fight past 4A number 7 Cedar Rapids Xavier, winning 47-41 in a Mississippi Valley Conference basketball game last night at Ron Thillen Gymnasium. Prouty said, I think we just chilled out after the first half. She posted 16 points and 15 rebounds. Especially rebounding helped them. The Trojans, 12-2 overall and 9-1 in the conference, enjoyed a 42-23 advantage on the glass on their way to their fifth consecutive victory. Xavier coach Tom Lilly said, they crunched us there. They had kids that did their jobs. We didn't really get into a rhythm. No flow. Trailing 35-32 late in the third quarter, West held the Saints, who were 11-6 overall and 7-4 in the conference, without a field goal for about 9 minutes, embarking on a telling 11-0 run. Prouty started it with an offensive rebound and put back. West coach B.J. Mayer said she's become a double-double. She brings the lunch pail every single time and has really become an offensive threat. Xavier led throughout the first half by as many as 6 points. It was 21-17 at halftime. Prouty's free throw gave West its first lead, 28-27, with 4:24 left in the third quarter. Kyla Mason led a 6-0 Xavier surge that put the Saints back up 3, but the rest of the game belonged to the Trojans. Mina Tate added 14 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists. Malay Lacey snagged 10 boards. Freshman Libby Fandel paced Xavier with 12 points. Lexi Byer scored 9, Mary Kate Motor 8. Xavier accumulated 17 steals, but the Saints had some lengthy scoring droughts and shot 29% from the floor. Mayer said, we didn't have a lot of energy at the start, but the kids buckled down on defense. And also on girls basketball, we have another little summary. Brunson's bucket lifts Lions over Warriors. Dateline Marion, Taylor Brunson converted a driving basket with 12 seconds left to lift Linmar past number 15 Cedar Rapids Washington last night, winning 54-53. Washington, 11-6 overall and 6-4 in the conference, rallied in the fourth quarter to take the lead. Arrow Thomas had a three-pointer with 1:25 left to make it 51-50. Then, Zoe Kennedy and Hannah Stolke exchanged basket before Brunson's game winner. Stolke missed a shot with 4 seconds left, finishing with 29 points. Kennedy had 20 points, and Brunson added 18 for Linmar, which is 10-6 overall and 6-5 in the conference. And then, courtesy of my husband, Kelly Neff, who kindly provided this to me, I can give you a list of some other girls' basketball scores that were in the Agate, as he calls it, from Saturday's Gazette. Cedar Rapids Kennedy over Jefferson, 60-58. These are all girls basketball. City High, 72, beat Liberty, 59. Iowa City Regina dominated Durant, 43-21. And my goodness, Clear Creek Amana had a clear victory over South Tama, 57-11. It was Mount Vernon beating West Delaware, 46-42. Cascade took charge of North Cedar, 69-32. Mid Prairie beat Bellevue, 52-45. And West Liberty really won over Tipton, 69-13. And it was a little bit of a closer one with North Lynn over East Buchanan, 52-49. And there is a boys basketball extended story here from Mara Levi, and it is Dateline Cedar Rapids. It has been 24 years since Cedar Rapids Prairie boys basketball team won a state title. Yet, with a strong senior class led by Elijah Ward, 2022 may be the year. Ward has been on Prairie's varsity team since his sophomore year and is now taking over the role of defensive stopper. Ward said, "It's an honor. That's how you know you're the best defender, and they rely on you to help the defensive side." Using defense as a tool to bring energy to the team, Ward has accepted his job of guarding the opponent's best offensive player, a feat not easily managed. Coach Jeremy Rickardson said he's taking that role and running with it. That has had an immediate impact. Ward is one of many multi-sport athletes on the Hawks team and has a love for football as well as basketball. He marginally favors basketball because of the environment, the fans, and the adrenaline of playing in a competitive atmosphere. Ward enjoys the game tactics and the teammates needed to succeed. His enthusiasm and transparent love for the game is noticed by his teammates and coaches. His favorite professional basketball player is the late Kobe Bryant, and he admits to learning by watching old clips. However, his number one role model is his dad. He said, "My dad is always telling me, if you want to be the best you can be, you have to work hard." This mentality and work ethic is reflected in his game. Ward leads the team in rebounds and is Prairie's third leading scorer. He intends to be a collegiate athlete, but remains undecided on the college and the sport, saying, "I'm either thinking about going to play basketball at Iowa Lakes or Iowa Western to play football. I'm leaning toward playing basketball." Ward plans to spend the spring improving his skills, getting stronger, and preparing himself for college athletics. With the help of Ward, Prairie's boys basketball expects to go far this season and compete at the state tournament. The Hawks played at Cedar Falls last night. And I am sorry to say that they don't give the outcome of that game, and when I go to their digital edition, I don't see it there either. So that is as much I can tell you about the boys basketball situation. There is no local business story, but there is one that is reprinted from the Detroit Free Press. I will read excerpts from that. It is titled, "Outraged by Bank and Credit Card Fees," and it's from Susan Tompor. Shopping around for a deal on a credit card seems like one of those things that's pretty straightforward. Low, eye-catching rates are plastered all over websites for those doing research online, and paper envelopes with special credit card offers pop up regularly in the mail. But are credit card issuers really all that competitive? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, also known as the CFPB, is taking a new dive into hidden fees, exploitative income streams, and anti-competitive financial practices that can hurt consumers. We all know hidden fees drive up our costs when buying concert tickets online, but some argue the same can be said about fees relating to financial services and products. Rohit Chopra, director of the CFPB, said in a call with the media Wednesday that many times banks and others obscure the actual cost consumers pay when selecting a specific mortgage, bank account, or credit card by highlighting an attractive offer, but then charging inflated back-end fees. Overdraft fees, late fees, check image fees, stop payment fees, closing costs, and a wide variety of other fees are examples. Chopra said, "By promoting competition and ridding the market of illegal practices, we hope to save Americans billions." The argument made by Chopra is that a new fee economy is distorting free markets, making it harder to comparison shop if you don't know how much money really comes out of your pocket. She said the agency is in the process of ending the banking industry's reliance on what he called exploitative sources of income. After the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, we saw more push from Washington, D.C. to improve disclosures. Late fees are clearly spelled out online in terms and conditions. Take a look at your credit card bills and you can spot the late fee there, too. But if everyone is charging the same fee, how much competition is there really? Or if the fee represents far more than the actual extra cost of a service, how fair is that? When will 0% cost you big money? Consider shopping for a 0% introductory rate credit card. Even if you have a good credit score and qualify for the card, you're still facing steep fees to transfer your debt from a high credit card to that one that offers a temporary 0% rate for, say, 9 months or longer. balance transfer fees can be found fairly easily if you carefully read the terms and conditions of an offer. They're not necessarily hidden, but many consumers might not easily spot them if they don't look or understand the real cost. In some cases, you could pay $90 to $150 in fees if you're transferring $3,000 from one credit card to another that has that limited 0% offer for a limited period of time. Is it worth your money? It could depend on how soon you'd pay off the balance and what rate you're paying now. The notion that balance transfer fees are so similar from one institution to the next, typically 3 to 5%, is a sign that the marketplace itself isn't competitive, according to a CFPB officials. They couldn't say what action might be taken or even when the timing could be for the next steps, and some announcements could be made this year and later. The CFPB is seeking feedback from small business owners, not-for-profit organizations, legal aid lawyers, academics and researchers, state and local government officials, and financial institutions through March 31st that may guide the agency forward. Our final story today is from the Living section. Elisha Decius has written this, titled Creative Outlets, Dateline Cedar Rapids. A growing number of institutions are recognizing not only the importance of inclusivity, but the evolving definition of what it means to be inclusive of people with different abilities and needs. For many organizations in eastern Iowa, that definition has grown over the last several years to include programming specifically for children with sensory needs and environment or materials that don't overstimulate their senses. Heather Wagner, an adaptive arts specialist and director of operations at the Eastern Iowa Art Academy, said, "There's definitely a need for these services. We've noticed we went from having 8 students in class to having 38 students." Wagner and the Eastern Iowa Art Academy have been providing art classes for children with autism and other disabilities for the last 7 years, and expanded their services into 5 organizations and local schools such as Washington High School and Jefferson High School in Cedar Rapids. With special air-dry clay, brushes, colors, and materials tailored to sensory needs, weekly classes provide outlets for expression that not only aids creativity, but teaches students with other disabilities how to express themselves and establish skills for life. For students who are tactile defensive, Washington High School teacher Amy Shoemaker said this programming is often overlooked as a critical need. With hand-over-hand movements and plenty of breaks, students are embedded with skills for life after school, such as choice-making and prioritization through fun projects like clay fish. Shoemaker said, "Through the art classes, we've seen them express themselves in ways never seen before." Other projects highlight often overlooked parts of art, its textile stimulation through sound and touch. Wagner said one student had a very hard time focusing on what they were painting. "We went around in a circle with a brush. We chose a paint that glided nicely on soft paper. She was just overjoyed by that." It's an experience traditional art would not have been able to provide her, and a simple joy many take for granted. Through art, they can articulate things outside of their verbal skills. Over the last few years, other institutions have caught on to these needs, too. In 2014, the Iowa Children's Museum in Coralville introduced sensory-inclusive events each year to give all kids an equal chance to get in on the fun. Amanda Thies, communications director for the museum, said all kids deserve to play and have experiences. Now, the museum has events one morning each month, a quieter time for families with special needs to get the most out of their visits. Thies said the thought process was instead of having one event a year, have an event that's accessible throughout the year. They were an early adopter among local institutions that has prompted others like the library to follow. Late last year, the Cedar Rapids Public Library earned a sensory-inclusive certification and started providing sensory bags with noise-canceling headphones, fidget tools, verbal cue cards, and weighted lap pads, also offering designated quiet rooms for a more secure environment. For a relatively quiet place like the library, the need came to the institution's consciousness in an unexpected way. Dara Schmidt, executive director of the library, said they were talking about it and we had a complaint from a parent who was using the library with their child, who was on the autism spectrum. The hand dryers in the bathroom were so loud that it was really disruptive and the kid was afraid to come to the library. Schmidt said, "I was definitely unaware of how things like that can be so overwhelming. It shows what matters to us and how libraries work as institution. Responding to our community needs is our responsibility to ensure we're changing along with our community to help those who need it the most." In February 2020, the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library introduced new sensory-friendly programming for those on the autism spectrum. And the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque is going to be offering its first sensory-friendly morning, February 6th from 8 to 10 a.m. And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette on Saturday, January 29th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff, and I've enjoyed reading with you. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and we thank you for listening.